From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It must be Anything Can Happen Day. Annette Funicello joins us on today's Fresh Air to talk about her days as a Mouseketeer, the Annette Sound, and why she never showed her navel in her beach blanket movies. She'll also tell us about the state of her health. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1987. Later, we talk with documentary filmmaker Allie Light. Her new movie, Dialogues with Mad Women, chronicles the lives of seven women who've been institutionalized. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, Being Human. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. House members are debating the merits of the ban on 19 types of assault weapons. Legislation banning the manufacture and sale of the guns is being heatedly discussed in the House chamber. Ohio Democrat James Traficant supports the ban.
The Second Amendment, the Constitution, makes sure that an American can bear arms and has the right to protect themselves. But the Constitution never intended for individuals to strap a Stinger missile on their back and then cite the Second Amendment privilege.
But opponents of the bill say the legislation is ineffective. New York Republican Gerald Solomon says the guns in question are used in less than 0.5% of violent crimes. He says the ban will penalize law-abiding citizens and not criminals. More members of Congress want to increase pressure on Haitian military rulers. Several are urging President Clinton to use force to oust the ruling Haitian junta. President Clinton is saying that he won't rule that out, but he wants to see if new strict economic sanctions will work instead. Israel says it has freed hundreds more Palestinian prisoners. The action is part of the Palestinian self-rule agreement. The deployment of a Palestinian police force, which is part of the agreement, has been delayed a week by Palestinian officials. The BBC's John Devitt reports.
There are many practical details to be settled, from who will be in charge of the day-to-day supply of provisions to the logistics of handing over police powers. The PLO is certainly unprepared for a mixture of reasons. On the one hand, the PLO has resisted sorting out the practical details until it's satisfied that Israel is going to withdraw. What might be described as Yasser Arafat's management style has added to the confusion. Palestinians complain that Mr. Arafat has been reluctant to delegate authority, possibly because he's afraid that this will create alternative power bases within the PLO. There's something of a cultural divide between the Israelis and the PLO. Israel believes that the Gaza Strip will descend into chaos when they are no longer there to organize things. But in reality, much of the daily life in the Gaza Strip has been organized by Palestinians for years.
John Devitt reporting. The African National Congress is close to winning a two-thirds majority in the South African Parliament. The latest results show the ANC with almost 65% of the vote. A two-thirds majority would give the party the power to control the makeup of the new constitution. The government says productivity of American businesses advanced 0.5% in the first quarter of this year. That's the weakest improvement in nearly a year. Meanwhile, a Labor Department report suggests that inflationary pressure is building because labor costs have increased to their highest rates in 3 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down almost 3 points at 3,694. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down a fraction of a point at 740. This is NPR. American Michael Fay has been lashed with a rattan cane 4 times in Singapore. The lashing was part of his sentence for vandalism. The prisons department says he and 9 other prisoners were flogged at Queenstown Prison today. Fay is also finishing his 5th week of a 4-month prison term. The prison's doctor examined Fay after the lashing and says he is in satisfactory condition. The case has sparked debate about whether Fay's punishment fits his crime. The caning rips and bloodies the skin and usually leaves permanent scarring. The Clinton administration has again pledged to build a new relationship with Native Americans. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt and Attorney General Janet Reno made that pledge in Albuquerque, where they've met with more than 200 tribal leaders. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Albuquerque.
Attorney General Reno told tribal leaders this morning that the new era of federal-tribal relationships is already underway. starting with last week's meeting between tribes and the president at the White House.
President Clinton has instructed every member of his cabinet to kick open the rest of the federal doors slammed shut for so very long. This listening conference is our step towards doing away with the old, closed way of doing business.
Reno and Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt are spending 2 days listening to tribal leaders. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Henry Cisneros joins the gathering tomorrow. Tribal leaders seem impressed so far with all the attention, but warn that the true test of the administration's commitment will come in administrative and legislative action in the months ahead. I'm Howard Berkus in Albuquerque.
A published report is finding trouble on the Alaska pipeline. The Wall Street Journal says more than 45,000 electrical code violations have been found on the 800-mile pipeline. The paper says that could seriously threaten its safety. For example, the paper says the pipeline might not be able to close down in an emergency. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Who's the little lady who's as dainty as a dream? Who's the one you can't forget? I'll give you just three guesses. Annette, Annette, Annette.
Annette Funicello was the most popular Mouseketeer on the Mickey Mouse Club. Her popularity outlasted her adolescence. After the Mouse Club ended in 1958, Annette had pop hits and then starred in beach blanket movies. Then she left show business to raise her children, and we saw her mostly on Skippy peanut butter commercials. In 1987, she starred in a send-up of her own beach movies, Back to the Beach. That same year, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Now she needs a walker at home and a wheelchair when she travels. That doesn't stop her from getting around. She's on the road now to promote her new autobiography, A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. I spoke to Annette Funicello earlier today and asked her first about the state of her health.
Well, you know, I feel terrific, and to see me from the waist up sitting, you'd never know anything was wrong. The problem is with my legs, the nerve endings, and the muscles are getting weaker, and there's really not much I can do about it.
Can we do some reminiscing like you do in your book?
Sure.
How were you picked to be a Mouseketeer?
Well, I was dancing in a little school recital, and Mr. Disney, unannounced, was sitting in the audience. And he saw me dance, and I guess liked what he saw. And he called, I guess there was a phone number of my dancing school in the back of the program. And he got in touch with my dancing teacher to see if I could come in for an audition. And that's really how it all started.
You must hear this all the time, but, you know, I grew up watching the Mickey Mouse Club. And, of course, like every kid who watched it, I wanted to be a Mouseketeer. And I remember one of my neighbors, who was about my age, you know, she was a girl, one day I saw her and she had these mouse ears on, and I thought, oh, God, I'm so jealous. She's a Mouseketeer now. How did she manage to do this? And, of course, I later figured out she just probably went to Disneyland or something and bought them. But, you know, those mouse ears were such a status symbol when you were a kid. How did you feel the first time you saw the mouse ears and put them on?
Well, it was a shock, because I think the first thing we thought, especially the boys, was, what do you mean I have to wear those things on my head?
Yeah, they were really stupid looking.
Yes, and it ruined the boys' pomp.
Right.
So it was quite a shock to us, especially since you don't have any idea about a premise of a show called The Mickey Mouse Club. It was weird.
True. This is TV was still in, kids' TV was still in its infancy. Disneyland,
yes,
was just getting started. So
yes,
what were the mouse ears made of?
They were beautifully made. They were the finest quality felt, and the ears were wired so they didn't flop around. And the girls had beautiful red satin bows, and we used to bobby pin them on, and They were very expensive. I mean, in those days, I guess they cost about $50 each. And if we accidentally laid them down on the set and couldn't find them anymore, they came out of our pay.
Were you ever in that position? Did you ever get fined?
I lost three ears, three pairs of ears. And yes, they came out of my pay. So we made sure that we left those bobby pins in and didn't lay them around anymore.
What were some of, what was the code of conduct for the Mouseketeers?
Well, I think with anyone who works at the Disney studio, it's kind of an unsaid, unspoken understanding. You're just a nice person, morally and physically. You just respect everyone there so much, especially Mr. Disney. I respected the man so much, and I had such great admiration for him.
I found it amusing in your book, you said you had to call all the adults aunt or uncle, so the makeup person became Uncle Makeup, and the hairdresser became Aunt Hairdresser.
Exactly. That's the way it was, and we didn't think anything of it. I mean, it was natural for us because we were a family.
Annette Funicello is my guest. She's written her autobiography. It's called A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. Did the Mouseketeers have boyfriends and girlfriends in the club? Did you have boyfriends in the Mouse Club?
Oh, you bet we did. I was crazy about Lonnie. Lonnie was a gorgeous blonde-haired boy with the great pompadour and a good dancer, an excellent singer, and I thought he was the most suave, debonair man I had ever met. And we went steady, and I think each Mouseketeer girl had her favorite guy that probably went steady with.
How did Mr. Disney feel about this?
He didn't know. No, it was all good, clean fun. And you know, there was no reason to tell him anything like that.
Well, he probably would have disapproved, don't you think?
Oh, I don't think so. No way. We were just such good friends, and we always had good, clean fun. And I think Mr. Disney approved of just about everything we did.
What was your favorite day of the week? Let's see, Friday was Talent Roundup Day.
That was my favorite.
Oh, okay.
I loved it. I was always interested in horses and, you know, being a cowgirl. And it was great fun. All the days of the week meant something. We had different themes. Monday was fun with music. Tuesday was guest star day. Wednesday was anything can happen day. Thursday was circus day. And then Friday was my favorite, talent roundup day.
I really envied you being able to wear the cowgirl suit. I desperately wanted to be a cowgirl when I was growing up.
Weren't they great outfits?
Yeah, yeah, they really were.
You know, they were. And those cowboy hats and the boots we wore. Everything was done in such good taste.
You write that you got so much fan mail, yet early on in the Mouse Club, you didn't know it because Disney kept a lot of those letters from you. He didn't want you to know how much you had caught on. Why didn't he want you to know?
Well, I think the first year especially, even into the second year, some Mouseketeers were getting more than others. So he didn't want any of us, I guess, to feel superior to any of the others. He didn't want any jealousy. And I think he was always so wise in every decision he made.
Were you disappointed when the Mouse Club ended?
It was the most devastating day I have ever had to go through. To say goodbye to people that you had worked with on a daily basis for three seasons, and you have friends like your siblings, it was awful. We girls were madly in love with our director, Dick Darley, and to have to say goodbye to him was more than we could bear. It was awful.
After the Mickey Mouse Club, when you stayed under contract with Disney, he had you start a recording career, but you didn't think of yourself as a singer. Was it very intimidating for you to be in a recording studio?
Well, I had been trained as a dancer and never as a singer, so I was uncomfortable singing always. Even when I had my first audition, and he loved my little ballet number, my tap number, and then he asked me to sing, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't sing. And I never had in public before. And he said, surely you can sing a couple of bars of something. And I had a favorite song on the radio at that time, and I sang that. So I was as comfortable as one could be, hating every minute of it. But I was familiar with the song, and he seemed happy with it. And he said, thank you very much. And I could tell by the smile on his face that he wasn't turned off by it. So I guess I wasn't as bad as I always thought I was.
Well, you had a recording career right after the Mickey Mouse Club, so why don't we hear the first hit that you had, and this is Tall Paul.
Chalk on the sidewalk, writing on the wall. Everybody knows it. I love Paul. Tall Paul, tall Paul, tall Paul. He's in my all. Chalk on the sidewalk,
chalk on the sidewalk.
Dishes on a tree,
dishes on a tree.
Everybody knows.
That's Annette Funicello, Tall Paul. Now, you didn't think of yourself as much of a singer, and there was what has come to be known as the Annette sound.
Yes,
that was
right.
Created in part to compensate for the fact that you were still a girl and you didn't have a real, like, singer's voice. What was the sound?
Well, Tutti Camerata, who was my musical conductor, knew how uncomfortable I was, and he said, I'm going to try something new. It's never been done before. I would sing the first time, and then I'd sing to myself, and then they would add a lot of echo chambers to it. We came up with the Annette sound, and it made my voice much stronger, and I felt much more confident with the echo chambers. So it was a good sound.
Annette Funicello is my guest. She's written a new autobiography called A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Annette Funicello is my guest. She's written an autobiography called A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. It was during the period that you were, you know, having, recording pop tunes and on the road with Dick Clark. You started a romance with Paul Anka. So did he write songs that were about you?
Yes, well, he had the big hit song, Puppy Love. And it was a great song. We were sitting in my mom and dad's living room one night, and we were talking about our romance and how crazy we really were about each other. And he said, what a shame everyone calls it puppy love. They don't know how we really feel. And I think he said, that's a great title for a song. Let me work on that. So he just sat at our piano and kind of fiddled around, and I guess later he went on to finish the song, and it was one of his biggest hits.
That must have been fun. Someone tells you how much they care about you, and they go, oh, excuse me, that's a great idea for a song, and then they leave you to go sit at the piano and work it out.
But that's the way Paul was. You know, he would think of songs at the most inopportune moments. He was a genius. I think he was really so far ahead of all the other pop singers. He was always more adult, had greater goals in mind. He didn't want to do just rock and roll shows.
During your recording career, you also started making your beach blanket movies. Those were not Disney movies. How did Disney feel about you, you know, wearing two-piece bathing suits in beach blanket movies?
Well, he had full script approval. Of course, I was on a loan out from Disney Studio at the time. He read the scripts. He liked them a lot. He came up to me one day and said, I want you to have fun with these. They're good, clean fun. I have a request to make, a special one, and see what you think of this. He said, I know all the other girls will be bikini clad. I would like you to look different. And would you mind not exposing the navel? So in other words, he didn't want me to wear an out-and-out bikini. And of course I didn't mind him asking me that. I respected him so much. And so many years later, that's kind of the running gag. Does Annette have a navel? Why did he ask her to do that? He was just so right on so many things.
Now, you had traveled most of your career up until this point with a chaperone of one sort or another, a parent or a tutor. During the beach movies, was the chaperone era over for you?
Oh, yes. It only lasted till I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on my own. But, you know, my mom or my dad or a friend would accompany me. I never traveled alone.
Was that good or did you want to cut loose?
No, that was very good. Because you have to, especially a lady, has to have someone with them for companionship, if nothing else.
You left performing when you started to have children. Did you feel you were able to have a quote, normal life after a whole childhood and young adulthood of being in show business?
You mean once I got married?
Yeah, once you got married and decided to leave show business for a while. I don't know how much of a normal life, so to speak, you were able to regain for yourself, well, since you were already pretty famous.
Well, I already knew up front that when I got married and started raising a family, that was going to be my number one priority, and it always was. Show business, I just sort of gently got back into it because a pal like Dick Clark would say, I'm doing a big special and could you appear on it? Please, could you just do me one favor? And then others heard that I had done that and asked if I would please do a show for them. So it was a very gradual kind of thing because people probably should have forgotten me. And I was so lucky that they never did. I think it was the name Funicello that stuck in their mind.
When did you start experiencing the symptoms of MS and realize that something was probably wrong?
When I was doing Back to the Beach.
That was 1987.
Yes. Yes, we did it in January and February. And there was something different. I had never experienced tingling in my fingers and my toes before. And I couldn't walk on the sand very well. And of course, that's not easy to do at best. But I knew there was something wrong, and I couldn't explain it.
when you found out that you had MS, it was several years afterwards that you decided to actually tell the public about it. But, I mean, even early on, you withheld the information from some of your family and some of your close friends. Why didn't you want people to know?
Because I didn't want anyone to worry about me.
Or to feel sorry for you?
Yes. I didn't want pity. That was very important to me. I just thought if I hit it, it might go away. And I walked with a cane, and I was lying. Every day I was telling a different story.
What kind of stories would you make up to explain the cane and the other problems you were having?
Well, that I had dancer's knees. It finally caught up with me. The old tendonitis set in. And, you know, I would always hold my left leg. But sometimes I would forget and hold my right. And people would say, but I thought it was your left. I mean, I was getting caught up in this pack of lies. And I realized when you lie, you have to remember. And I wasn't. So I knew it had to end soon. I had to do something about it because I wasn't happy.
Was it a relief when you started telling the truth?
Oh, it was like such a weight was taken off my shoulders. I felt so much better. I got rid of that ghost in the closet. It was awful. It was awful because I thought I was hiding it well enough sometimes, but then I'd slip up. And the old tendonitis story wasn't working.
What has the experience of reliving your past to write this book been like?
Well, I would say three quarters, even more, 99% of my past is full of such wonderful memories. I mean, too numerous to even mention. This last bout that I've had really threw me for a loop for a while.
The bout with MS, you mean?
Yes. And, you know, I've learned to accept it. You have to accept it. Because I want to be able to fight it. I want to keep up my strength. I don't want to give in to it. And I want to keep a smile on my face for others, too.
Do you think that whole thing of wanting to keep a smile on your face has something to do with the Annette persona? You know, the public Annette.
Yes. I know it has everything to do with that. Because I don't want to disappoint anybody. And I basically am a happy person. I'm not putting on any airs. I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm a happy person.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It has been a great pleasure.
Annette Funicello has written her autobiography. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
M-I-C.
See you real soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.
M-O-U-S-E.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Dialogues with Mad Women. Ali Light's new documentary features interviews with women who have been institutionalized because of mental health problems. Light tells her own story in the film. 30 years ago, she committed herself because she was so depressed, she feared she would hurt herself or her children. Her film won the Freedom of Expression Award at the Sundance Film Festival. Also, critic Stephen Schiff reviews Being Human, Robin Williams' new movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House has started debating a ban of 19 types of assault-style guns. Three former presidents are urging passage of this legislation. Both sides say the vote is too close to call. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Debate has begun on the ban, and the arguments haven't changed since the last time the House took up gun control legislation. Supporters say it's a step toward controlling violent crime. Opponents say it's a step toward banning all guns and taking away the rights of law-abiding citizens. As members launched into 3 hours of speeches, three former presidents weighed in. In a letter, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan all urged House members to listen to the law enforcement community. Most major law enforcement organizations support the ban. If passed, the measure would stop production and sale of 19 types of assault-style guns, copycat models, and it would limit detachable ammunition magazines to 10 rounds. It exempts 650 specifically named rifles and shotguns and would not take away any guns now legally in private hands. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Reuters News Service says the Whitewater special prosecutor has subpoenaed all White House files that relate to Vincent Foster. Foster was the deputy White House counsel who killed himself last summer. Reuters is quoting unidentified administration officials who say the White House plans to release a statement soon promising full compliance. President Clinton says the United States will set up a $600 million aid plan for South Africa. Mr. Clinton says the money is a substantial increase in aid.
Over the next 3 years, we will provide and leverage about $600 million in funds to South Africa. For this fiscal year, we have increased assistance from $83 million to $143 million. Along with guarantees and other means, our resources, which will be mobilized for next year, will exceed $200 million. Through the programs of 10 U.S. government agencies, we will work with South Africans to help meet the needs which they identify.
Nelson Mandela will be inaugurated as South Africa's newest president next Tuesday. Vice President Al Gore will attend the ceremony, along with First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton. The Bosnian Serb vice president says a truce will take effect around the town of Brčko within 48 hours. Bosnian Serb and Bosnian government fighters are confronting each other around the town. Bosnian Serb leaders have been meeting with United Nations military observers to discuss the fighting. Brčko is a small link in a slim land corridor that connects Serbian-held parts of land in Bosnia and Croatia. The Serbs have accused the Muslims and Croats of trying to break that corridor. Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials fell almost 2 points to close at 3,695. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. Yemen is now in civil war. Northern and southern troops are battling in the streets, and Air Force jets have attacked rival capital cities. Residents of Sana'a say southern jets struck the airport and presidential palace in the northern city. Sana'a, the capital, was the capital of former North Yemen before it merged with South Yemen 4 years ago. North Yemen had a conservative government, while South Yemen had a Marxist government. They had merged in May 1990, forming the Arab Peninsula's first democratic republic and the most populous nation. New York City authorities say a helicopter crash has killed at least 2 people and snarled traffic at the Lincoln Tunnel. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC has this report.
Authorities say the helicopter went down shortly before 1 o'clock Eastern Time, crashing in a park and ride lot on the New Jersey side of the Lincoln Tunnel, which carries commuters under the Hudson River into and out of Manhattan. Officials have closed all tunnel traffic heading out of the city. In addition, both lanes of busy Route 3, which funnels commuters toward the tunnel from New Jersey, have been closed. The Bell helicopter started a fire upon impact, sending thick smoke into the air. Port Authority officials say a dozen cars in the parking lot caught fire. The accident and outbound closure of one of the city's busiest commuter routes promises to make this evening's rush hour slow for thousands of motorists. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The Canadian International Trade Minister says he's ready to negotiate with the United States on Washington's threat to halt Canadian wheat imports. Roy McLaren says Canada might be forced to retaliate if the United States imposes restrictions on durum wheat and other grains that come into the American market, but he didn't say which U.S. products could be targeted. American farmers say Canadian grain is subsidized by the Canadian government, thus it's dumped on American markets. McLaren says that means Canada and the U.S. need to agree on definitions of subsidies and dumping. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Seven very articulate, insightful women discuss their own experiences with manic depression, psychosis, self-mutilation, and multiple personality in the new movie Dialogues with Mad Women. One of the women who recounts her story is the film's director, Allie Light. She committed herself 30 years ago during a blinding depression. She spent 3 months on the day ward of a San Francisco hospital. Dialogues with Mad Women won the Freedom of Expression Award at the Sundance Film Festival. Light's previous documentary, In the Shadow of the Stars, won an Academy Award. She made both films with her partner, Irving Saraf. Dialogues will be shown tomorrow night at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Next month, it opens theatrically in 30 cities. Light told me about the depression 30 years ago that eventually led to her new film.
I was a young mother, 28 years old. I had 3 children under the age of 6. And I was gradually beginning to think that my life was over. And now I realize that I was sinking into depression, and it wasn't a fast thing. It was a slow thing. My husband had been going to school for many years, and he had, even though he was struggling very hard, and he ultimately ended up taking care of me and the kids and doing his beginning teaching, I still felt that he was having the one who was having the adventures, and I was the one who was standing at the door every day saying goodbye, and this person was going out into the world, and I felt that that wasn't happening to me, and I didn't think it would ever happen.
In your film, you say that when you got really depressed, you were afraid you might hurt yourself or your children.
Yes.
When did you decide, well, I'm going to go to the hospital, maybe the hospital can do something for me?
Well, I was in therapy, and the first thing that happened is that the therapist, on an outpatient basis, put me on some very heavy-duty kinds of medication, which further intensified the depression. First thing was Stelazine, and then he tried some antidepressants, which were just new on the market. And they all made me feel stranger and more disjointed and more detached from myself. And as that happened, as that began to happen, I sort of lost control, what control I had left. And it was his suggestion then that I go in the hospital. But of course, I signed myself in.
When you first committed yourself, there was a psychiatrist who I can sense from your movie you didn't think very highly of. And he asked you a very disturbing question after you told him how depressed you were. What did he ask you?
That's a very hard question. That's a very hard story for me to tell, even though I tell it in the film. It's not easy because of the humiliation. He came into the room after I was undressed, and I guess I don't know why it's so important that when you're being admitted to a hospital, to a psychiatric ward, that you have to take off all your clothes, but that's what happened. And I was telling him about my medical history and the kind of medications I was on, and he really sort of interrupted me. He was standing behind me. I didn't see his face. And he suddenly asked me if I'd like to kiss my husband's penis. And, you know, it's been, what, 30 years or more. I remember to this day my feelings. It was like being stabbed in the back. And it's the kind of question that there's really no answer for in a situation like that. I was so torn about what to say. I absolutely did not know how to answer him.
What did you say?
Ultimately, I said sometimes, because it went through my mind very quickly, if what would happen, what he might think if I said yes, and what he might think if I said no. And so I tried to save myself the best way I could by saying.
Do you have a clue why he asked you that?
I think he was titillated by the fact that he was in this room with this woman with no clothes on, that he was probably looking at me from behind, that I was very young and very, the power was very one-sided in the room, and that he just, it was a titillating question to him, and he thought he could get away with it because he didn't, it wasn't the kind of question that evolves out of a series of questions that you might be asked about your sex life or about how you're functioning or anything. It just came out of the blue.
Did the hospital help?
Not really. I guess it helped in two ways. It helped that I wasn't alone and that somebody was watching me and that I was not in danger of hurting myself. I learned how to play volleyball on Thorazine. That's the only thing I remember.
That's a useful skill.
To this day, I can't stand to watch people play volleyball.
Let me ask you to tell the JFK story about when you were in the hospital.
I was in the hospital in 1963, and I was coming back. And what happens is that you have a therapist on the ward who takes you to his office, and you have your therapy session there. And we were coming back from that therapy session, and a young man ran down the hall, and he was shouting, and he had pulled a telephone out of the wall, and he was holding the receiver in with a trailing cord. And when he saw the doctor with whom I was walking, he began to shout to him that the president is dead, the president has been killed. And the doctor's first thought was to turn to me and say, don't pay any attention to him, he's just hallucinating. And that was the assassination of John Kennedy. And all those years later, I thought to myself that he couldn't even believe this. I mean, he didn't have it in him to believe the story that was being presented to him because of the person who was telling it to him, someone who was certified and incarcerated. And so even when you tell the truth, sometimes it seems like a delusion to the person who's in charge, who has the power there.
Do you see your film as an indictment against psychiatrists and mental institutions?
I see the film as much of a true story as I could tell, and I think that's what we try to do as artists and filmmakers, is to tell the truth. But I think that what people remember after they see the film is my story about the admitting doctor or Dee Dee's story about the therapist who molested her. They may not as easily remember that another woman was really saved by her therapist, and another woman who had a bad therapist then got a good therapist who did help her. So I tried to be as balanced as I could.
When you were in an institution, this was in the pre-feminist era, and I think that really figures into your experience a lot.
Figures into the kind of assignments and the kind of things that I was told by the doctor who later treated me at Langley Porter.
Yes, to tell us, for instance, like what he wanted you to do when he was going to let you out for.
Well, he gave
period.
Me assignments, mm-hmm. And the first assignment was that I could go home on the weekend if I would bake a turkey, and I did that, and I did the other assignments. Another one was to go home and mop all the floors in my house, and I know now that he was trying to fit me back into a situation from which I was trying to escape, but I didn't know that at the time. I thought that he was doing his best to get me back on my feet. And so I tried to follow his instructions, and I did those things, and I hoped it was making me better. And that's as enlightened as I was at the time.
What's it like for you to look back on that period when you felt trapped by your life and didn't really know if you'd be able to find a way out of it?
Well, you know, sometimes I think I understand it better, and sometimes I think I'm not sure. All the pieces are still not there. But a few years later, when I really discovered feminism, it was like my eyes opened wider than they've ever opened in my life, and I saw, it's not that there were instant answers, but that suddenly I understood my life in a way that I hadn't before. It was very eye-opening, and made a tremendous change in my life.
My guest is Ellie Light, director of the new documentary Dialogues with Mad Women. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Allie Light, director of the new documentary Dialogues with Mad Women. In this excerpt, one of the women interviewed in the film, Hannah, describes her condition.
The common diagnosis is manic depression. What got me on the lithium then, when I was back down into the depression, was Quentin Bell's biography of Virginia Woolf, right? And I see her through her life go up and down and up and down. And then in 65 she was, or 62? I mean, so late in her life, she sticks the stones in her pockets and walks into the lake. And I said, aha, that's not happening to me. I am not going to kill myself unless I decide I want to do it. I'm not going to have these depressions make me do something against my will, because I don't feel like the depressions are me. I feel like I'm taken over by something. So that very day when I finished the book, I had a therapist appointment. When I went to see him, I said, okay, I'll take the lithium, you know, fine, which he had offered to me when I was high. And I took a lithium in the office, and I took a bunch home with me. And when I got back to the house, I sat down on the couch, I fell asleep. I was so depressed, everything was great. And when I woke up from the nap, there was like a little spot of blue in the sky. I mean, really not very much, but just enough to know that the lithium worked. And I'd realized that each depression, the thoughts of suicide were growing. And of course, that I continued in my life to have these kinds of depressions, then eventually I could end up like Virginia Woolf and walk into the lake with the stones in my pocket, which I didn't want to do. The thing that's hard about it is that I do believe in these non-ordinary realities. There's something trying to emerge. And it feels intensely alive, which is why it's so hard to give up. And it's so imaginative.
Now, how did you find the women who you interviewed in your movie?
They were all friends of mine. At some point in my life, I knew most of them for a long time. Two of them were students of mine. There were women who heard my story in the class and told me their stories. Hannah, the woman who, I call her the woman who loves Bob Dylan, she was my student.
She's a manic depressive who was just absolutely obsessed.
Yes, yes.
With Bob Dylan.
But I love her so much, and she has the sweetest spirit and the most determination of anybody I know to try to keep her life on an even keel, and that's very hard when you have these tremendous ups and downs.
There's something that Hannah says. She's the woman who's manic depressive and obsessed with Bob Dylan, that I thought was very telling. You know, she's a terrific storyteller, and she holds the camera awfully well. But she says at one point, you know, I'm perfectly charming for an evening, but try living with me and you'll see what it's really about. And I thought, yeah. I mean, I really understood what she was talking about.
She has a lot of insight into herself.
Yeah, because she's also the person who described in the most disturbing way her fear that she'd be alone all her life, that she'd never find her, quote, soulmate, and that the agony of thinking of a life alone was so great, she thought she would kill herself if she didn't believe that maybe sometime in the future she would meet the right person.
And she begins that sentence by saying that that she bought the romantic ideal lock, stock, and barrel so that she can also stand outside and say, well, this is a romantic image, and maybe such a thing as a soulmate does or doesn't exist, but it doesn't matter whether it does or doesn't. I want one. I need one.
Your film ends on a very disturbing note that was obviously something you couldn't possibly have planned for. A woman named Karen, a Chinese-American woman who you interview in the movie, who was in, you know, she tells about the discrimination she faced growing up and about joining radical groups when she got older and, you know, the depression that she went through, how the radical groups kind of kicked her out after that. And her last words were about how at this point in her life she really wanted to be alive. And then the viewer finds out shortly afterwards that before the movie was completed, she was raped and murdered. Do you have any idea what happened?
Well, I know that it had nothing, that her what happened to her had nothing to do with her previous life, that it was a matter of being stalked by someone and murdered, not because she had once been on Thorazine and had the life that she talked about. Karen and I met when we both joined the Writers Union, and I loved her very much. She was my friend, and she was actually the first person I talked about making the film with. She was the associate producer. Her job was with the San Francisco Opera as a fundraiser, so although she had never done film before, we thought we could work together. She could raise money and all. And she's the first person I called when we got our first grant. And so it was horrible. It was horrible to find out what had happened and to get a call early in the morning about what had happened, that she had been murdered. And so I couldn't do any work at all on the film for almost a year. I just cried about her and had dreams about her trying to save her and all the things that you do when somebody that you care about dies. And I finally began by looking at the material by shutting the sound off and just looking at the picture and looking at her, all the footage, because there was a 2.5-hour interview with her. And then when I could do that, then I could turn on the sound, and then Irving and I could get back to work on the editing of the piece.
I have a question about your movie and watching the women talk about their lives. I was wondering if you were making the assumption at all that their problems, their depression, self-mutilation and things like that, were caused by sexism and racism and social pressures.
I didn't start out with any notions or ideas about what the film was going to do. I think I work in an intuitive or maybe a more unconscious way. I wanted to get the stories down first, and so they were very long, the interviews. I certainly didn't set out to make a film about child sexual abuse, and look what happened. I mean, 4 out of the 7 women were sexually molested as children, but that wasn't what the film was about. Mm. It just happened that that's the way our lives went. I never do neither my partner or I do anything like market research to talk to a lot of people and then decide who's going to be in the film. There were only the 6 women besides myself that I knew from the beginning were going to be part of the film. So the film is the way it turned out the way it is, but there was nothing that I started out to do.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ellie Light's new documentary, Dialogues with Mad Women, shows tomorrow night at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Next month, it opens theatrically in 30 cities. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we will have a report from Capitol Hill from Elizabeth Arnold on the House vote on assault weapons. We'll be taking an advance look at the primary in Pennsylvania. And the election in South Africa has produced another surprising result. The National Party appears to have won a state. Robert Siegel will have the second part of his piece on welfare. This one deals with deadbeat dads and programs to get them back in shape in paying child support. And also, we have a report from Joe Pelka on the Cryolophosaurus, which is a newly discovered dinosaur.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For a while, Scottish director Bill Forsyth looked as though he were taking the world by storm. After his art house hit Gregory's Girl in 1980, he made Local Hero, which wound up on a lot of critics' 10 best lists in 1981. But his next two films, Housekeeping and Breaking In, were less successful, and he hasn't gotten a film released for 5 years. His latest movie sat on a shelf after it was finished in 1992. It's called Being Human, and it stars Robin Williams. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Actually, it's a little surprising that Warner Brothers chose to release this movie at all. Not because it's terrible, it's not, but because it's anything but mainstream. Forsyth's idea is to sum up what it is to be human by telling 5 stories set in various historical and prehistorical eras. But when the movie begins, your heart sinks. There's a voiceover, and the voice belongs to Teresa Russell, an actress who has always had the persuasive subtlety of a Toyota Sailathon. Once upon a time there was a story, Russell says, and the story said to itself, "How shall I begin?" At which point I was saying, "Let's talk about how you should end." Then we see Robin Williams wearing Bronze Age rags and scampering goat-like across the mountains with, as if he needed it, extra hair between his eyebrows. And you want to say, "Quick, bring on the hungry dinosaurs." This caveman story's downright bad. But then we go to the Roman Empire, with Williams playing a slave and John Turturro playing the distraught master. And suddenly, everything works. The sequence is funny and poignant. And despite the hokey togas, the tone is perfect. The next two sequences are variable. One has Williams returning from the Crusades and having to choose between his family and the beautiful stranger he meets along the road. The one after that is about a party of 16th century Portuguese explorers shipwrecked on the African coast, and Williams looks unexpectedly dashing in it with his pointed Don Quixote beard. Finally, the movie arrives in contemporary New York for what turns out to be a surprisingly rich portrait of a divorced father who's spending the weekend with his two kids for the first time in years. The preciousness of Forsythe's screenplay sometimes gets in the way here, but at other moments it's beautifully observed. You can hear a little of both in this scene, in which Williams talks astronomy with his 10-year-old son and gets a good talking to from his teenage daughter.
Hey, Thomas, look. There's old Mercury. Remember, we used to watch stars together. You could name all the planets. You could recite them like in a poem. Sit up in that window, that little window at the old house. You remember?
No. And that's Saturn.
Sorry. Glad you kept up with your astronomy. That's real good.
I'm not into stargazing so much. At school, we're working on a computer model of a biosphere for deep space travel.
Everything's going to be okay.
What do you mean, going to be? This is it.
What?
I told you, Dad. This is as good as it gets. This might be the best moment of your life. How much better do you want it?
Not much.
Enjoy it.
Thanks for the tip. Will.
The movie's very carefully structured. It begins with the caveman losing his family, and it ends with the New York divorcee in a way regaining his. In between, we see various ways in which men are captives, looking for freedom and love. Literal captives, like the slave Williams plays in the Roman sequence, and subtler captives, like the New Yorker wired to his real estate deal, his cellular phone, his crazy life. Echoes and cross-references are sewn very elegantly into every sequence, and Forsythe and Williams both have a whimsical touch that keeps the movie from feeling too portentous. Unfortunately, the whimsicality also keeps it from being gripping, forceful, or memorable. Being human doesn't quite work, but it still made me wish that Bill Forsythe would work a lot more.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Stephen King's miniseries, The Stand, begins on Sunday. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Stephen King about his writing and about some of the incidents in his life that have truly terrified him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.